East Coast is experiencing a blizzard that could affect up to 100 million people, while here on the West Coast, we saw the driest year on record. So on today's Media Roundtable, we're going to look at coverage of the environment this year. News about climate increased by 30% in 2013. What were the other trends in ecological reporting? How is the way we consume environmental news affecting our ability to address global climate change? Where did you see great reporting, and what would you like to understand better? Join our conversation on Your Call with me, Holly Kernan, and you after this news.
BBC News with Marianne Marshall. The United Nations says worsening violence in the Central African Republic is hampering efforts to help almost a million people who've been displaced. The country has been plagued by sectarian violence since a coup led by mainly Muslim Seleka rebels last year. Imogen Folkes reports from Geneva.
The UN Refugee Agency says the number of people sheltering at Bangui Airport has doubled in the last week to around 100,000, but that many more are hiding in the bush, fearful of attack. The ongoing violence is making any relief effort extremely difficult. Civilians are being targeted, the UN says. Armed groups are turning up at aid distribution points, and looting is widespread. Despite the presence of French and African Union troops who have secured the airport so that aid can be flown in, the violence and insecurity is making delivering supplies to surrounding areas almost impossible.
There's been another day of fighting between Iraqi forces, backed by local tribesmen, and militants linked to al-Qaeda in two cities in the west of the country. In Ramadi, forces supporting the government say they've inflicted numerous casualties on the Islamist militants. There have also been street battles in nearby Fallujah. Sebastian Usher reports.
The fighting in Anbar has developed into a major test of strength for the Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki. He ordered security forces to break up a long-running anti-government protest in Ramadi on Monday. The confrontation with Islamist militants quickly escalated. Under the flag of the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant, also fighting in neighbouring Syria, truckloads of jihadists poured into Ramadi and Fallujah. Government forces are battling to win back control. They're backed by local Sunni tribal fighters whose main militia was instrumental in enabling US troops to win a long battle against insurgents in Anbar just a few years ago.
The international medical aid group Médecins Sans Frontières has confirmed reports that five of its staff have been taken from their house in northern Syria, allegedly for questioning. The group says it's doing all it can to re-establish contact with them. Earlier, unconfirmed reports, posted online by activists, suggested that jihadist fighters had raided an MSF-supported field hospital in the province of Latakia. The report said the militants were from the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant. Ethiopia says direct talks between the government and rebels in South Sudan will begin in Addis Ababa on Saturday. The negotiations are aimed at ending 3 weeks of violence between the supporters of President Salva Kiir and those loyal to his former deputy, Riek Machar. The two sides have already met regional mediators. Ethiopia said the talks had been fruitful. Clashes between the two sides are continuing, with reports of heavy fighting on the outskirts of the rebel-held city of Bor. World News from the BBC. A state of emergency is in force in New York and New Jersey after a big winter storm hit the northeastern United States. Hundreds of flights were cancelled and major roads closed. The storm caused snowfalls of more than half a metre, and residents are being asked to stay in their homes. The Italian Navy says more than 1,000 migrants have been rescued from boats in the Mediterranean since Thursday. Navy helicopters spotted four badly overcrowded vessels in trouble with more than 800 people on board. They were safely rescued. In another incident, a boat carrying more than 200 migrants was towed to Sicily. The Italian Navy has stepped up patrols in the waters between Italy and North Africa after hundreds of mostly African migrants died in a shipwreck off the coast of Lampedusa in October. A Second World War bomb has exploded at a construction site in western Germany, killing one person and seriously injuring two others. The victim was operating a digger that disturbed the bomb. Explosives from the Second World War are still frequently found in Germany, as Damien McGuinness reports from Berlin.
The Second World War bomb was discovered by accident during excavation work in an industrial park on the edge of town. It exploded when it was disturbed by a digger as the machine lifted up earth and debris. The machine's operator was killed on the spot. Police say that the explosion was felt up to a kilometre away, smashing the windows of some local shops and homes. Although the war ended almost 70 years ago, unexploded bombs are still regularly discovered in Germany today.
The Real Madrid footballer Cristiano Ronaldo is to receive Portugal's Order of Prince Henry. Ronaldo was awarded the honour for raising the profile of Portugal and for inspiring children. He's the country's best-known sportsman and will lead Portugal at this summer's World Cup in Brazil. BBC World Service News.
Welcome to your call. I'm Holly Kernan in for Rose Aguilar. Back east, they're snowed in and experiencing severe storms that may affect up to 100 million people. Here in Northern California, we had the driest year on record in 2013. Does anyone even remember rain? We'll get used to more extreme weather as we experience more of the effects of global climate change. A year-long investigation from Global Post finds drastic climate changes have sparked economic dislocation, political discord, and even death. And it's happening right now in nearly every corner of the planet. Global Post goes on to say there is no bigger story on the planet and none that so dramatically shows that, yes, we are all in this together. So today we're going to spend the hour discussing the year in environmental reporting. The Daily Climate reports that coverage of climate change issues jumped by 30% in 2013. We'll find out which environmental stories got the most media coverage and what slipped by without media attention. And we'll ask how the reporting is changing the political debate and informing civic action. Joining us for today's media roundtable, Solana Payne is senior video producer at Global Post. She was part of a team for the year-long investigation into global climate change called Calamity Calling. They say, forget the debate over global climate change. Calamity is already upon us. And over the next 10 weeks, Global Post will be featuring stories and videos, one every week, in a series that they're calling Calamity Calling. Hi, Solana.
Hi there. How are you?
Fine. David Sassoon is founder and publisher of the news nonprofit Inside Climate News. Last year, Inside Climate News won a Pulitzer Prize in national reporting for a series called The Dilbit Disaster. In July of 2010, more than a million gallons of oil spilled into the Kalamazoo River, resulting in the most expensive cleanup in U.S. history. Hi, David.
Hello. Good to be here.
Good to have you. And we're also joined by Mark Hertzgaard, the environmental correspondent for The Nation and author of Hot, Living Through the Next 50 Years on Earth. For the past two decades, Mark has written about global warming for a number of outlets, including The New Yorker, Vanity Fair, and The Nation. Hi, Mark.
Hey, Holly. How are you?
Good. And so some of you are back there experiencing this severe weather that we're talking about. So we'll hear about that in a minute. But as we always do on Fridays, we begin the show by giving kudos to a journalist or an outlet that has done a good job reporting. Today, we're going to ask you, though, to have your pick of the year in environmental reporting. I'm sure you have a few, but why don't you just name one? And let's start with you, Mark.
I'm going to shock the KALW audience by singling out none other than the Wall Street Journal. And I know that's shocking to people because the Wall Street Journal has probably been the single most important voice in the American climate denier media machine for years. And so I make this only partly tongue-in-cheek, though, because maybe it's finally even beginning to dawn on the Wall Street Journal, because late this year, on the op-ed page of the Wall Street Journal, which has always been, as I say, the prime real estate in journalism for the climate deniers, they actually published this fellow named Al Gore. You may have heard of him. And Mr. Gore, along with a very prominent investment specialist, was making the case for the need to price carbon and to leave most of it in the ground. which is, I think, quite stunning to see that finally, that argument finally finding its way onto the op-ed pages of, you know, the newspaper that is the most powerful in shaping opinion within the financial elites.
All right, so kudos to the Wall Street Journal. How about you, Solana?
I want to call out the Seattle Times. They did an amazing series on ocean acidification, which is sort of one of the, I think, less covered aspects of climate change and one of the scariest. It's a beautiful series, multimedia series. It's really, really impressive and both highlighting what we're seeing right now much faster than we expected and what we can expect to see in the future.
All right, Seattle Times, ocean acidification. And let's go to you, David.
You know, I'm not going to call out a particular news organization, but the research work that was done by Carbon Tracker and that got coverage all over the place that spoke about the carbon budget, and it made it into the IPCC report. And basically, for the first time, the financial world is taking stock that their investments in carbon-intensive industries may be at risk pretty soon. So it's a very big story that, similar to what Mark said, is penetrating the halls of power on Wall Street and the financial sector.
Yeah, and it does seem like the debate around this is shifting. So I'll ask you about that in just a minute. You're listening to Your Call. I'm Holly Kernan. We're talking about the year in environmental reporting. I want to point to a front page article in today's New York Times that talks about Secretary of State John Kerry. And it says, Kerry quietly makes a priority of an elusive goal, a global climate pact. And it talks about Kerry initiating a system of a top-down push to create an agency wide focus on global warming. So I was wondering, maybe we'll start with you, Mark, about this New York Times article and also just your assessment of Mr. Kerry as Secretary of State with regard to global climate change and global warming and the Obama administration's record on the environment.
Sure. I've been doing some of my own reporting on this, and it is certainly true that Secretary of State John Kerry has long been a very outspoken advocate for environmental progress, and in particular on climate. My own reporting indicates that he, along with John Podesta, who has now re-entered government, and he was the White House Chief of Staff under Bill Clinton and was Barack Obama's transition chief. Mr. Podesta has now gone back into the White House as the top-level counselor to Obama. And they are clearly trying to push some kind of an international deal to get some agreement internationally, especially with China, in the lead up to the next big international climate negotiations, which will take place in 2015 in Paris, and where the presumption is that some kind of a deal will finally be cut. So that is a major push of the Obama administration. It hasn't gotten much attention yet, but I suspect we'll be hearing more about that this coming year.
And you're working on a long piece for Harper's.
I am. I'm doing a very long piece on the environmental record of President Obama, how it compares with what he promised as a candidate in 2008 and what he has done as president, and why he has not done more, in particular, after promising so much as a candidate in 2008. And the long and short of it is, as on so many issues facing the Obama presidency, Mr. Obama has actually achieved much more than most people know, but also not as much as he could have on climate policy, and certainly not as much as the science requires. And the big, big question there is how long he will continue to be such a full-throated backer of his so-called all-of-the-above energy strategy, which, yes, pushes solar and wind and renewables, but pushes fracking of natural gas and oil drilling and coal production even stronger. And that is the fundamental contradiction at the heart of Obama's climate policy.
And there will be an article on that by Mark Hertzgard in Harper's. Let's hear from Solana and David real quickly on this question of the Obama administration's record and how they compare with the previous administration, the George W. Bush. David, why don't we start with you?
Well, I mean, it's certainly an improvement, but he has not been as courageous as you would think he would be, given all the statements he made. In the campaign, the last presidential campaign, he didn't even mention climate change. And, you know, he's done some things, but he has yet to do anything that is more than, you know, what's to be expected. I mean, mileage improvements in the auto industry, those were long overdue. And the auto industry was essentially owned by the government, you might say, for the bailout. So the government had a lot of leverage to get that thing finally done. So, there, you know, Keystone is the big issue, and he has mostly been watching it get kicked down the road. He did make a statement that Keystone would be decided to some degree on whether it will worsen climate change or not. And that was a significant step, but that's talk. So there's still a master stroke that the world is waiting for him to show leadership and in a way that will change not only the national dynamic and conversation, but the global one.
And we expect to have a decision on the Keystone XL pipeline later this year. Is that right?
Well, so they say.
So
but,
they say. Although,
you know,
yeah, I heard that last year as well.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, from one point of view, it serves him not to make a decision.
And Solana, I don't know if the Global Post's year-long investigation into this looked at policy, but did you want to weigh in on the Obama administration's record on the environment?
I mean, we didn't look at policy kind of intentionally. We were focusing really on the effects that you're seeing. I mean, I would agree with what's been said and say this is it's such a massive problem, and so little, I think shockingly little, really has been done to try to stem emissions in a way that would make a difference. And so I think it definitely has been disappointing.
Okay, so I wanted to ask each of you about your assessment of the coverage of climate change in 2013 and if this really did represent a year where the tone of the coverage really changed and the depth of the coverage. The Daily Climate just published reporting on stories about climate change, and they found that coverage of climate change issues jumped 30% in 2013. The Guardian took a different angle, saying that climate media coverage was a mixed bag with a continued false balance and inaccurate reporting from politically conservative media. And the New York Times eliminated its environment desk. So what is your assessment of kind of the overall change in coverage of the environment, particularly climate change in 2013? Mark, you want to start us off?
Sure. I think there have been some very good individual stories that have been done, but that overall, I would be pretty critical of the U.S. media's coverage. Let's be clear here. This is a very separate from how the rest of the world and our journalistic colleagues overseas. Climate is a much bigger story there and integrated into coverage of politics and economics and weather, for example, in a way that we just don't see here in the United States. If you were watching the coverage, for example, of the tragedy of Typhoon Haiyan in the Philippines, U.S. coverage made very little reference to the fact that this hurricane was one of the most powerful that's ever been measured, much less have they referenced the connection to climate change there. So in general, I think that the U.S. media is still way behind, and I'm not just referring to Fox News and the right-wingers who have decided long ago that they're not going to let the facts get in the way of their portrayal of climate change. Even the mainstream news organizations, they're still treating this with that kind of false balance that you mentioned earlier. But having said that, it is important to see that at the New York Times, which is a very important outlet, obviously, in the U.S., we've seen some very good reporting. I thought Justin Gillis's piece, when the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, came out with their report in late September, the first of the fifth assessment report studies, the New York Times got that story right, and they put it on the front page, and they got what was newsworthy there, which is that now the IPCC, like a lot of other international establishment institutions, has essentially adopted the argument of Bill McKibben and said that 80% of the fossil fuel reserves on this planet have to stay in the ground, unexploited, unburned, unprocessed, if we are going to have a chance at surviving and avoiding climate calamity. That's a big shift on the part of the New York Times to have done that. At the time, granted that they've stopped their general coverage, it's nice to see these isolated stories at least showing that, that kind of reporting can be done.
And Solana, do you feel like you're seeing that same shift in the way that climate change is being covered and the environment in general in the U.S.?
I was cut off for a second there, so I missed a little bit of the second answer. But I would say I think that there has been a positive shift in tone in the sense that there are more stories questioning, looking at what's happening now and how that is related to climate change. I would also say that we have increasingly on the internet so many more outlets that are doing really amazing coverage, small places, and you have to look for them, but not just, obviously Inside Climate News is doing great stuff, but also, China Dialogue, a site that started up that just looked at China related to the environment. Places that are doing stories, important stories, that I think wouldn't have made it necessarily even into English before. Maybe they were covered elsewhere. I think that's a definite positive development. While I agree that the issue of false balance in climate change reporting has been, something I think journalists in the U.S. have wrestled with since the moment when we started talking about climate change, and it is troubling that it continues to be an issue, particularly here, and also that I think journalists tend to be afraid to really tackle science, and it's become such a political issue in the U.S. that it seems to make people even more reluctant to talk about things, even things that have, vast scientific consensus behind them.
And David, I want to ask you about the same question, but first I want to invite our listeners to join our conversation on Your Call. We're examining the year in environmental reporting with David Sassoon, founder and publisher of Inside Climate News. Solana Pine, you just heard, is senior video producer at Global Post, and Mark Hertzgaard, who's the author of Hot, Living Through the Next 50 Years on Earth. Our number is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. And what do you think about the quality of reporting on environmental issues and particularly climate change? And you can let us know about great reporting you've read or heard or seen this year, and let us know what you want to understand better. And are you concerned about climate change? We're experiencing spring-like weather this winter in California. Does that seem unusual to you? Or how are you conserving water? How are you looking at the environmental coverage differently? 866-798-TALK. It's a toll-free number, 866-798-8255. So David, we were talking about kind of the assessment of the year in environmental coverage, and if there has been this shift, subtle or not, in the way that the environment and climate change is being covered in media, what do you think?
I think there was a shift after Hurricane Sandy in the general consciousness of most people in America, a lot of people in America, I'll put it that way. And I think the media, in some ways, is following suit. The extreme weather events, disasters that we're seeing in the oil industry are making people question what the next generation of infrastructure should look like when it comes to energy, given the climate impacts that they're experiencing. And so there has been a shift in the tone of the conversation, although the larger context is that American media has failed us, and, in general, for the last decade on this issue of climate change. It has been one of the great failures. The understanding and the urgency of the issue has not penetrated the awareness of most Americans and our political system. So it's an incremental improvement, but at the same time, you are seeing the environmental journalist profession diminishing. Not only the New York Times closing down their environment desk, but if you look at the number of environmental journalists who have a job at a major daily, even the smaller papers, the numbers are shrinking. So it's a dangerous time in that regard. And we're doing what we can to fill in. A lot of other smaller outlets are doing the same kind of thing. But the big megaphones still belong to the big media. And, you know, it's still a problem we're facing.
And let's bring our first caller into our conversation on your call. Hi, David. David in San Francisco, welcome to your call.
Hey, greetings, and Happy New Year. You know, I had two of them, actually. The first one was Obama has offered to help in the cleanup of Fukushima if the Japanese will drop the lawsuits against General Electric. And, of course, General Electric has been pretty well hidden from the whole Fukushima story. They're the ones that designed the reactors, and they're still attempting to build one down in North Anna, Virginia. But the second story is a little bit older, but it's still very pertinent, and that's in Haiti. The people of Haiti, after the big earthquake, tried to raise their minimum wage from 31 cents an hour to 61 cents an hour. And, of course, in the cleanup of the great earthquake down there in Haiti, you know, that would have doubled their wages to 61 cents. Looks like a pittance to us, but at least it would have been a start. And the Obama administration fought it every bit of the way and got it up to, they only got it up to 37 cents an hour minimum wage. So the aftermath of that great earthquake still is not to be resolved by the people of Haiti. It'll have to come from some other source.
And David, we're running up against a break. Do you have a question for our panelists?
Well, no, it was just those two stories that the environmental problems, and of course the Haitian earthquake was tied to the environment. Global warming is raising the oceans, so it's putting greater hydrostatic pressure on all of the lowlands, coastlines and lowlands.
And Solana, thanks, David, for your call. Solana, we just have about 2 minutes before we go to a break. Do you want to highlight a little of what the Global Post's investigation found?
Well, we went to a variety of places. So we looked at the Amazon, for example, and research, which is basically trying to figure out, the Amazon is under threat. It's drying out. Fires are spreading farther into it. It's shrinking, and the question is, could we reach a turning point where we actually lose the Amazon, and what would that mean for the world? I mean, it would be pretty terrible. And you know, we talked about the fate of the lemurs in Madagascar as a species that, you know, it's an adorable little animal, but it's also incredibly endangered. At the kind of edge of these climate effects that we're feeling around the world, and the way that climate is affecting it is possibly relevant to, you know, all other kinds of animals, and is this the kind of, you know, these extinctions that are happening more and more frequently? And we looked at kind of what we can learn from the lemur. We looked at what's happening in the Sahel in North Africa, particularly in Mali, where they had a coup and they had al-Qaeda-linked extremists take over a part of the north of the country. And we looked at links to climate change. That region has been racked by drought. All predictions are that drought is going to continue to get worse. And people in the country are telling us that that is pushing, you know, farmers and herders who used to be able to survive off the land into the hands of extremists who can pay them very well for fighting with them. So we looked at the ways that climate change is exacerbating conflict, particularly in these kind of hot spots around the world.
And that's at Global Post. We'll put a link to all of that at yourcallradio.org. You're listening to Your Call. I'm Holly Kernan, and we're examining the year in environmental reporting with Solana Pine, who's a senior video producer at Global Post. She was part of a team for the year-long investigation into global climate change called Calamity Calling. We're also joined by David Sassoon, who's the founder and publisher of the news nonprofit Inside Climate News, and Mark Hertzgard, who is the environmental correspondent for The Nation, and he's the author of Hot: Living Through the Next 50 Years on Earth. And you can join our conversation by emailing us. We have full lines right now, but you can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org. Again, it's feedback@yourcallradio.org. I'm Holly Kernan, and you're listening to Your Call. We will be right back after this short break.
All of the stories you hear recommended on the Friday Media Roundtable are posted at yourcallradio.org. That's where you can comment on the show by email to feedback@yourcallradio.org.
For those of you joining us now, I'm Holly Kernan, and this is Your Call. We're podcasting our show. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. You can also listen to past shows there and find out what's coming up next. On Monday, how should government do technology? We're going to talk about the failed Affordable Care Act website and how the government can do better with tech. According to a recent op-ed in the New York Times, healthcare.gov is only the latest episode in a string of information technology debacles by the federal government. So what's behind that trend and how can we do better? Today, we're discussing the year in environmental coverage, which stories got the most attention, and which important ecological issues were mixed. What makes you pay attention, and what turns you off? You can join our conversation by emailing us at feedback@yourcallradio.org. We're joined by Solana Pine, who's a senior video producer at Global Post, David Sassoon, who's the founder and publisher of Inside Climate News, and Mark Hertzgard, who is the environmental correspondent for The Nation. And let's go to Roberto from Daly City. Hi, Roberto. Welcome to Your Call.
Thank you very much. There's two points I would like to raise, and they're actually questions as well. And one is I don't perceive or believe I've seen an adequate job of tying in the population growth and the use and destruction, the use of industrialization, and the destruction to the global nature of the world that affects what we're doing now. And it's always been perceived as how is it being performed locally? And that is an issue which I know is hard to approach, but needs to be tied in. And the second is I agree with you that the media, in its largest essence, has not done anything to actually address this issue. I'm going to raise a question of why there hasn't been any such film, for example, like Testament. I don't know if you remember that, but when Testament, a made-for-television movie, came out, one would think, well, it was a made-for-television movie. What difference, what impact did it make? But when the talks were going on nuclear arms reduction, it was a huge impact for the public supporting that action, when before that, they did not. And basically, it came down to not having a positive ending. Oh, everything will be all right. It showed exactly what was going to happen, what will happen, what could happen, what would happen with the results. And I think that would make an impact, at least for a while.
All right. Thanks, David. I'm going to get the panelists to reply. And I guess to piggyback on David, how do you think that the coverage, the way that we cover the environment, is affecting the debate about how to take action to slow or reverse climate change? Mark?
Look, the mainstream media in the United States never covers things from the perspective of how do we make social change. They are, by definition almost, a reflection of the establishment, of the inner circles of power. They look at what is happening in Washington, and in particular in the Congress and in the administration, and that's the perspective from which they report. So you see oftentimes talk as if there is no real climate movement in this country. And in fact, there is. There's quite a strong one. And it has won some important victories, such as stopping new coal-fired power plants in the United States. And yet, when the mainstream media covers that story, they totally ignore what this grassroots movement called Beyond Coal has been doing for the last 10 years of building local power in red states, by the way, you know, in Kentucky even, in Illinois, in Iowa, in South Carolina, and all these places, and stopping the plans to build new coal-fired power plants. Instead, the way the mainstream media covers that is that when the Obama administration's EPA announces, as it did last April in 2012, that it was going to issue these rules on new coal-fired power plants, all the news stories credit the Obama administration for stopping new coal. And that's not at all what happened. That's, you know, they came along after the stopping had already been accomplished by the activists. So that's the nature of the mainstream media, and that's why it's so important, by the way, that people turn to independent media like Your Call, like KLW, like independent radio and television voices and internet voices, so that you can get a more rounded view of what's going on.
That's Mark Hertzgaard. He's the environmental correspondent for The Nation. He's the author of Hot, Living Through the Next 50 Years on Earth. You can join our conversation about the year's news in environmental coverage by calling 866-798-TALK. It's a toll-free number, 866-798-8255. What environmental stories got the most attention this year, and which important ecological issues were missed? What makes you pay attention, and what turns you off? 866-798-8255. So let me ask you about that, in terms of how the coverage affects how we talk about this, and whether people just sort of feel like I have to throw up my hands, I can't do anything about this. Do you have a wish list for journalists and for listeners who care about this issue? Are there words or framing we should avoid?
Well, I think the big issue that we're not talking about is environmental security.
Hmm.
We talk a lot about energy security. We are extremely energy secure, and we make it seem as if we're not. We have more energy than anybody can use, and we want to export it, et cetera, et cetera. What we're not seeing is the cost of that, and how those costs are going to impact us as we keep going in this way, if we do, into the future. It's a question of environmental security, and it's everything from the weather that impacts people, which we've been seeing. It also has to do with, do you have a pipeline running through your backyard? Does somebody have the right to condemn your land and take it so that they can put a pipeline through your land? Are there regulators powerful enough to be able to keep an eye on the next generation of infrastructure that the energy companies want to put in? Are we making decisions for ourselves, or are these kinds of decisions being made for us? So that to me is the real story right now in this century, is this conflict between energy security and environmental security, and how we're going to resolve that. Of course, climate change is at the center of this thing. And until we start to really realize that we have to actually do something, that conversation about this tension is not going to be given, a full airing and awareness, so that everybody can weigh in and understand what's going on around them.
And Greg writes in, reporters are reluctant to talk about such a politically charged scientific issue. That's completely ridiculous. Is war any less controversial? Is immigration less controversial? Science reporting can easily be good. Reporters just have to be disciplined in pursuit of the truth rather than chasing the latest lurid story and losing interest like children over time. Reporters, journalists are properly thought of as scientists in pursuit of the truth. By that measure, they are nearly all miserable. Failures. That's from Greg. Did you want to weigh in on this, Solana, about the way the coverage affects the way we talk about this and how we do or do not take action?
Yeah, I mean, I think that were you going to say something?
No, go ahead, Solana.
Sorry, I think one of the science advisors for this project that we interviewed sort of talked about how nothing is going to change until people kind of get together. He used the movie Independence Day as a metaphor that, like, people need to kind of get together and realize they're being threatened in the same way. And to some degree, I think, you know, the coverage is starting to talk about the ways that this is threatening us. But it's the kind of issue that I think people in general tend to want to ignore. It's massive, and some of the changes that are required are probably going to affect, you know, a lot of the things that we like to do, like take long road trips, or the way that we heat our house, or the way that we eat. And so it feels like it's got difficult solutions, and the threat still feels fairly distant. And so I think that until that really changes, until people start to say, no, this is affecting me now, this is affecting my children, then it's hard to make the difficult choices necessary to do something about it.
And as you've all pointed out, it does seem like this year, though, there has been a bit of a shift in the idea that this is actually affecting all of us and will continue to do so in more acute ways as we move into 2014.
Could I offer a thought there?
Yeah, please.
This is Mark Hertzgard.
Hi, Mark.
Look, we just said earlier in this program, I think it was David who said that Hurricane Sandy, which is, you know, just 13 months ago, provided that moment. And I've been covering climate change long enough now, 20 years. I've heard, you know, numerous times people say, oh, if we can only just have another, you know, disaster that gets the point across to people and realizes, then they'll change. And that hasn't happened. You know, Hurricane Sandy, yes, it changed the elite opinion for a while, and I was much more optimistic that it would have a lasting effect precisely because it struck in the heart of where of the headquarters of the United States media, New York City. Mm-hmm. And so it was no longer a case for those anchormen and producers and editors and so forth that this was some foreign thing that happens in the Philippines when there's a bad typhoon. No, it hit New York. And nevertheless, climate change has not become a continuing story. And partly that is the things that we've mentioned about the constraints on the media. But let's not put the cart before the horse here. Believe me, things would be very different if you had a president of the United States who was speaking out on this in the way that the times and the urgency of climate change requires. And Barack Obama, although he has begun to talk a little bit more in 2013 about climate change, and says that it's important to his legacy, and he mentioned it in his inauguration, he mentioned it in his landmark speech at Georgetown over the summer in June, he has not really used the bully pulpit to the extent that he could. And if he were to decide to do that, and there is my own reporting from inside the administration indicates that they're thinking about this, the fact that they brought in John Podesta indicates that they want to do this, they really are going to sort of mobilize the executive branch. But if the president were to really make an issue of this and continue to talk not just once or twice, but to talk repeatedly about what is coming and what I'm, as president, going to do, believe me, the news coverage would follow. So let's not go too far. As critical as we deserve to be of the poor coverage in the media, let's not overlook the fact that you know, the president really is somebody who needs to be called out on this as well.
And let's go to another caller. John in San Francisco, welcome to your call.
Good morning. Thank you for the show. I have two issues. I consider myself an environmentalist. I'm a member of Sierra Club, and I contribute to other environmental organizations. However, it seems as though the voices, and this is not meant to disrespect any of your guests who are excellent, but it seems though the strong voices that can be heard on a nationwide basis are disappearing on this issue. For instance, Al Gore, what happened to him? He made such a great start with his Inconvenient Truth story that had such great impact back then. And the other issue is that I've kind of lost the argument concerning the XL pipeline. Because if they don't build the pipeline, they're just going to ship the oil over rails and by trucks, which is worse than the pipeline. And so I'd like your guest to respond to that, please.
All right. Thanks, John. Why don't you start, Solana?
You know, actually, I really can't speak that much to the effects of the pipeline in terms of why haven't we had another Al Gore, or why hasn't Al Gore been more vocal? Again, that's not something that I particularly look into. I mean, I think this question of, like, there are these moments, and that movie was one of them, when people seem to galvanize behind climate change, it gets a lot more attention, people start talking about it, and then the momentum seems to be lost. And I mean, I think that it's true, the political leadership has been lacking, and I sort of think that the same kind of gerrymandering that led to the economic shutdown that we've seen has led to, you know, very extreme members of Congress, many of whom say that climate change isn't happening, which is making it, you know, very hard to get anything done.
Are you, David, optimistic about the way that the sort of science of global warming is, the coverage of that is changing?
Boy, look, can I just address that question about the rail?
Sure.
That was asked? I mean,
the Keystone XL?
Yes. I do not think it's possible for a rail to replace pipelines. It's a stopgap measure because they want to get the product out. They're using unsafe railway cars, and they're having more accidents, as we're seeing. And it is not really a sound argument to say, well, we might as well let them have the pipeline because they're going to do it anyway and do it worse. That should not be the way a decision is made on something like that. And rail cannot replace pipelines. And every CEO of every major company in Canada, the oil companies, the pipeline companies, when they speak to their investors and they are under fiduciary obligation to tell the truth, they, and not doing public relations, they say that the Keystone Pipeline and other pipelines are crucial to the plans for developing the Canadian tar sands. And without them, without these pipelines, the development will slow and investments will flee, et cetera. So I don't think the rail argument holds water if you really look at the numbers and what the industry leaders are saying themselves.
And let's go to another caller, George in San Francisco. Welcome to your call.
Hi, how you doing?
Hi.
We would hope that you would link to a story that came out the 31st. That would be, I guess, 3 days ago on the Stephen Sherwood, a researcher who headed up a study of the climate dynamics. And the report is out of the University of New South Wales, which says that we actually might be ramping up for a much larger increase in temperature by the end of the current century than previously anticipated. And the figure that they were citing is 7.2 degrees Fahrenheit by the year 2100, given that cloud cover will vanish at an increasing rate, and that in and of itself will cause a greater warming because of less of the sunlight being redirected away from the planet. I'm sure some of your guests could comment on this. I guess the point is, if you have only 35 years worth of water supplies, it doesn't matter if you have 70 years worth of coal or petroleum or nuclear or anything else, because you can't use it if you can't cool it.
Why don't we have Mark, who wrote Hot, Living Through the Next 50 Years on Earth, respond to that. And George, we will put a link to that article by Steve Sherwood at yourcallradio.org, where we'll put links to all of the articles we've talked about today and the work of our guests. Go ahead, Mark.
Yeah, I'll respond briefly to that. And then I want to also mention a genuine piece of good news, because so often these conversations just focus on the bad news. And Lord knows there's plenty of bad news. There have been a number of studies out this year. And you can never read in too much to one individual study, but there are a number of studies that are coming out that say that, you know, yes, the temperature rise, the World Bank has said the temperature rise could be 4 degrees Celsius by 2060, and that would essentially create an uninhabitable planet. But what's important to realize is that these are all decisions that, to some extent, we can still affect by changing our policies, especially our economic and political policies. If we were to put a price on carbon, that would immediately change the calculus, not just, as David properly pointed out, for Keystone XL. That's a lie, by the way, that they're going to just run it with the railways. They can't. It's not economical. But all of those decisions will change if we put a price on carbon. There's many ways to do that. So we shouldn't ever feel like these things are you know, irrefutable and unchangeable. And then the positive thing, and what is the single most hopeful story I personally have written this year, is something that I've been surprised has not gotten more attention outside of the business press. And this is the absolute economic boom in solar power globally. Solar power is growing so fast around the world, not just here in the United States, but also in Germany, in China, in a lot of other countries. It's growing so fast that the adoption rates for solar power are now faster than the adoption rates have been for cell phones. Now, if you think back 15 years ago, almost none of us had cell phones. Today, pretty much everyone does. That's how fast we, as a species, kind of picked up cell phones, including in villages in the third world. Solar power is now being adopted even faster than that in Germany, where they're planning to be to leave both nuclear and fossil fuels behind by 2030, as, by the way, a terrific book that David's group published on this, Clean Break, I think it's called, documents. And in China, they are going to be half renewable and half fossil fuel by 2030. Here in the United States, and especially in our home state of California, we're rocking ahead on solar. And solar, the reason this is happening is that solar is now so cheap. And so you've got marketing forces that are going to be driving solar and wind, but especially solar, increasingly into the electricity grid.
And
that is happening even under today's biased rules that are still biased in favor of fossil fuels. So if we were to change those rules, as Obama wants to do, and put a price on carbon, we could still turn this around in time. And that's a story, the solar story, that has gotten attention in the business press. I wrote about it in The Nation. You can find it on my website, but it has not really yet penetrated the front pages.
Can I, Mark, can I ask you a question about that? It seems that there is enormous resistance on the part of utilities to let the solar energy in, and even, you know, to allow distributed generation to happen in this country because it cuts into their business. Germany succeeded because they broke the monopoly of the utilities. In this country, it's far more complicated, and there is all kinds of efforts by the utilities themselves to put up barriers. Did you report on that, or do you know anything more about that?
I have not done detailed reporting on that, David, but you're summarizing the situation quite accurately, and it's with one caveat that I would add, is that, yes, that's exactly what the utility companies are trying to do. They're essentially trying to fight a rearguard action because they see that, you know, their business model is a 19th century, perhaps early 20th century business model, and they literally are not going to be able to compete. So what they are doing, like all entrenched industries, is they're using their existing political connections to try and thwart the innovators. But, you know, the solar executives that I interviewed for that Nation story, you know, some of them even said, you know, I kind of feel sorry for those solar guys. They get it that their model, their business model, is doomed, but they don't really know how to get out ahead of it. These solar guys even said they think that there are ways for the utilities to adapt to a renewable energy future, but they would have to get out of the defensive attitude that they're in now of trying to block renewables and embrace it and change their business models.
And we're running out of time in this hour. I want to end with optimism and activism. On the Inside Climate News website, David, you have a recommendation for people's New Year resolution to be to boost their knowledge of climate change. What do you want people to understand, and what do you want them to be doing? And you have about a minute.
That's an interesting story. If you look at who is providing these online seminars, you're looking at the World Bank, you're looking at MIT, you're looking at these big institutions that are providing education online for people who want to learn about climate change. I think those are really important efforts, but I would like to see the media and all of us connect the dots more so that every energy story is really a climate story. That's the bottom line.
Energy story is really a climate story. And Solana, how about you? What, after this big year-long investigation from Global Post, what do you want your audience to take away?
I want my audience to take away the fact that this is affecting our lives, it's affecting everybody's lives, and that, you know, if we don't take action now, things like the way of life that we know that we've grown up with is at risk.
All right, so take action now. And we're going to give you the last word, Mark. What activism would you like to highlight? I mean, there is activism happening all over the country around fracking, for example. You mentioned the Keystone Pipeline. What optimism would you and activism do you want to highlight for us?
Yes, quickly. I think the fracking movement is the most significant one historically, and it partly because it builds on the Keystone XL pipeline. I think fracking is going to be the big issue of 2014, along with what President Obama decides to do. And there, again, as always, no president can take on the richest and most politically powerful industry in human history, the fossil fuel industry, without constant, sustained, determined pressure from the civic society, from all of us, from activists. They cannot do it. No president can do that on their own. So this president needs to be pushed. He needs to be encouraged. He needs to be
What's your call to action for the audience? What specifically would you ask them to do?
It's that famous old line that came out of San Francisco radio in the 60s. If you don't like the news, go out and make some of your own.
All right. Well, we're going to have to leave it there. That's Mark Hertzgard. He is the environmental correspondent for The Nation. He's also the author of Hot, Living Through the Next 50 Years on Earth. We'll put a link to all of the articles and information that you heard at yourcallradio.org. We've also been speaking with Solana Pine, who's a senior video producer at Global Post. She was part of a team for the year-long investigation into global climate change called Calamity Calling. We'll have a link to that at yourcallradio.org. David Sassoon is founder and publisher of the news nonprofit Inside Climate News. Last year, they won a Pulitzer Prize in national reporting for a series called The Dilbit Disaster. All of that information will be at yourcallradio.org. You can also use the comment section of the website to put links to articles that you think are important and continue this conversation there. And I want to thank everybody for joining us, and please be safe in the storm. I'm sorry that we couldn't get to all of your phone calls and your emails. We just had so many callers. But we will put links to all of this information at yourcallradio.org. I'm Holly Kernan, and this is Your Call. How should government do technology? On the next Year Call, we'll talk about the flawed Affordable Care Act website and how the government can do better with tech. According to a recent op-ed in the New York Times, healthcare.gov is only the latest episode in a string of information technology debacles by the federal government. So what's behind this trend, and how can we do better? Join the conversation on the next Your Call with me, Holly Kernan, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or to sign up for our podcasts, visit yourcallradio.org. You can also friend us on Facebook. Ali Budner and Malihe Razazan produce the show. Matt Martin is the executive producer. Phil Hartman is the chief engineer. Debbie Kennedy is our studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.